Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence and whose extraordinarily courageous service to our country, both in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps and since he's taken it off, is our first guest. His name is Fred Galvin, now a retired United States Marine Corps major. A man who led a distinguished unit known as MARSOC 7. When I say distinguished, for a time it was distinguished by many hateful things that were said about it, but it has been exonerated, I'm happy to say, in the course of a decade or so of manfully trying to get the record set straight by Fred and his comrades and others. We have finally had an affirmation by the United States Marines that they did act in a sound and professional way in the course of a deadly ambush that was perpetrated on them in Afghanistan back in 2007. Fred Galvin, we've talked about this at length in the past. I wanted to just give that sort of quick précis of what you have been through, you and your guys. And I guess I'd like an update on how you all are doing since you got word that the Commandant of the Marine Corps has, in a fashion, formally exonerated you all of any wrongdoing.
Yes, thank you, Frank. The men are in a better position professionally with jobs. It is an issue still that they aren't given jobs at their educational pursuits, what they have been able to conquer academically. You know, they're not at peer and there's not a parity. And there's still the stigma inside the military circles is some of these men still are actively serving in Marine Special Operations, and they do have this stigma held against them, which there does need to be a complete public exoneration and expungement to where there is no doubt. And that's what happened to a degree, not from a man in uniform, but the Honorable Congressman Dana Rohrabacher said a week ago in front of the House of Representatives, a very clear statement on the congressional record. And those of your listeners that would like to look at that on the congressional record of 6 December, Dana Rohrabacher made it very clear of the facts that happened in the courtroom and, you know, the assumption that was made and how these men were dragged through the mud and what actually happened and was proven in the courtroom.
Yeah. We'll put that insert for the congressional record, those remarks in the congressional record, in our website, securefreedom.org, so people can find it very conveniently. But I do want to thank both Dana Rohrabacher as an old friend and Congressman Walter Jones, about for whom this has been a very important mission for a very long time, for their work on it. Fred Galvin, you have also had some of these difficulties, perhaps to the extent some of your men have. But I also want to just salute you for the tirelessness with which you have sought to get this record corrected and the hateful things that were said about your guys, for doing their job, for defending each other and acquitting themselves properly in a very dangerous situation, only to be defamed by people up their chain of command as having somehow killed innocent Afghans or otherwise conducted themselves dishonorably. Remedying this record is, as you say, something that has been done to a point, but I did want to just draw you out on what else can and should be done at this point to make sure that those serving, for heaven's sakes, most especially, are not any longer doing so under any kind of cloud, but also that those who are no longer in the military are helped to fulfill their potential. They're distinguished and extraordinary warriors, that's for sure. But they're also people who are capable of, I'm sure, rendering great continuing service to our country in other capacities. What would you recommend that people in our audience and the rest of us do to try to help?
Well, because of the seriousness of this nature, I mean, they accuse us of an atrocity. They said it was 19 Afghan civilians that were killed, 50 that were wounded. This is one of the highest alleged body counts, and it has destroyed the health of many of our Marines who were accused, their families and their careers, and that has not been fully restored. We have asked the Marine Corps to have a public statement and bring these Marines in so that there is no doubt. And that is the missing piece. At this point, you know, the Marine Corps has had that opportunity. His Congressman Jones has led that charge. We are asking that, you know, those listeners, their families, make this known through the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Mattis.
Himself a Marine, of course.
Yes, a retired Marine, over 40 years, been in combat. He knows this case very, very well. And he, as the Secretary of Defense, has the authority to make that public statement to come out and make sure that there is no doubt in anyone's mind so that these Marines who, many, as I said, are still serving, there's not that doubt. I've seen many others get promoted, and these Marines are held back. Although they're doing the normal deployments overseas, they're going into combat still to this day, they do have the stigma against them, which is wrong. And I do thank you for mentioning my cause in this. But, you know, as the Marine Corps leadership shows, you know, I was there with them that day. I was their commanding officer. And that's just what we do when someone is put in charge. That still is a burden on my heart. And I believe that this can be corrected, as we've seen several congressmen. And now we plead for the listeners to make this known to Secretary Mattis.
Yeah. Well, I know that Dana Rohrabacher is leaving Congress. Is Walter Jones as well?
Walter Jones had an unopposed reelection.
He's going to still be there. But this is a topic on which we could really use a few more hands, needless to say. This is something that I think all of us who admire the military, who support the troops, who feel very strongly that those who put their lives on the line for the rest of us deserve everything we can do to make their mission successful, including help them when they are wrongly accused of having violated rules of engagement or otherwise conducted themselves in any manner other than fully honorably. That needs to be fixed. And I just wanted again to say, I know this would not have gotten fixed to the degree it has to this point without your leadership, your continuing command guidance, Fred Galvin. And I appreciate it, and I know your troops do as well. And we look forward to continuing to work with you on exposing what's happening here and to enlisting the help of as many of our audience and others as we possibly can to support the MARSOC 7. And their full and public rehabilitation, exoneration, whatever you want to call it. It's what you deserve, and we'll keep at it. Thank you so much for joining us today, Fred, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Joe DeGeneva is in the house, I'm very pleased to say, at least virtually. Joe is, of course, these days a partner with the law firm of DeGeneva and Tensing. He is also a former U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia. He worked on Capitol Hill in a number of capacities, notably as the chief counsel and staff director for the Senate Rules Committee. He was also chief counsel for the Senate Judiciary, Governmental Affairs, and Select Intelligence Committees, and an independent counsel in his time as well. A man of great distinction, particularly in his ongoing public service, which I'm happy to say is now obvious at places like Fox and on our program from time to time. Joe DeGeneva, welcome back. It is so good to have you, sir.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Well, where to begin, Joe? I guess with the saga of General Flynn. I have known him for quite some time and have been horrified, really, by what I've seen happen to him. But with each passing day, it seems to be more and more clear that Michael Flynn was really a victim of a miscarriage of justice here, more than a man who somehow violated the laws of the United States. But your informed assessment of this, tell us.
Well, you're absolutely right. He was a victim. There was a plot, which, as you know, included the desire to exonerate Hillary Clinton, and if she lost the election, to frame Donald Trump. Part of that plot included ensnaring the incoming administration, Trump administration, in criminal investigations. Sally Yates, the then acting attorney general, along with James Comey and the people at the FBI, decided that they were going to entrap General Flynn, who had done nothing illegal. They had intercepted General Flynn's communications with the Russian ambassador. Whether or not those interceptions were legal remains to be seen. But the truth is, the conversations that General Flynn had with the Russian ambassador, both on the transition team and as the acting national security advisor, were all legal. There was no violation of law. But Sally Yates decided she was going to create a possible crime, and she said to Comey that it might be a violation of the Logan Act, the unenforced don't be a foreign agent for another country. The bottom line is they went to interview the general at the White House. They lied to him. They said it was just routine. They told him not to have a lawyer. He spoke to them, and their agents even concluded when it was over that he had not lied. And yet 7 months later, the notes of that interview had not been put into what's called an FBI 302. Eventually that happened. Mueller decided to indict the general in order to try and put the squeeze on the president. In order to save his family, General Flynn pleaded guilty to no crime and a crime which he did not commit. And now he's up for sentencing. And the issue becomes, what does Judge Sullivan do now, knowing that General Flynn was framed and that there may have been shenanigans with the 302? I predict that if the judge is convinced that the FBI lied to him, he will throw out General Flynn's convictions on the due process grounds that his conviction would shock the conscience of the court, and he has been denied due process. We may be headed toward that glorious ending in this horrible story created by the Obama intelligence community and Justice Department.
Wow. This would be indeed a remarkable turn of events, Joe DeGeneva, from your lips to God's ears, as they say. How does this tie in, if at all, Joe, to what our friend John Solomon at The Hill has been reporting in the past day or two about these Defense Intelligence Agency documents? Interestingly enough, General Flynn, of course, was the director of DIA at a point. But this seems to be yet another turn in this screw of this story that, like Judge Emmett Sullivan, I think is likely to shock the conscience of a lot of people.
What we now know is that there are documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency which show that there were illegal intercepts of American citizens' telephone numbers by the Obama administration, which led to the ruling by the FISA court in April of 2017 that 82% of the inquiries made by FBI contractors seeking the names of Americans in intercepts, 82% of those requests were illegal. Those illegal intercepts led to the unmasking of American citizens illegally and then the leaking of those names illegally to the press. Most particularly, the one that stands out as number one is the leaking of the conversation between General Flynn and the Russian ambassador. The unmasking of that conversation and the leaking of it to the Washington Post, to David Ignatius, was a crime. Whether or not that crime is being investigated by DOJ is unknown to us at this point. That is what Huber, the U.S. attorney in Utah, is supposed to be investigating. There is no evidence that that is being done. If that is true, if it is true that these crimes are not being investigated, then it is a joy that Jeff Sessions was fired.
Hmm. Huber is a man whose name has popped up from time to time, Joe DeGeneva, but we certainly haven't heard much about his investigation, which, as you say, is supposed to be looking into, we're told, the various criminal activities, apparently, of Hillary Clinton and her team. You say there's no evidence that some of this is underway. Is there any evidence that any of it is underway?
None. None whatsoever, other than the statement by Attorney General Sessions a year ago that he was appointing someone to look into these things. That was a sop to Senator Grassley, that letter that Jeff Sessions sent saying he was investigating all of these things. In fact, even though Huber has been appointed, there is no evidence whatsoever that after all this time he has done anything. He certainly has returned no indictments. No one has been charged. Now, it could be that Mr. Huber is very good at preventing leaks about his work. But in after this length of time, I can tell you that if I were the prosecutor, Joe DeGeneva, I would have discovered by now who leaked the conversation about General Flynn. I don't believe anybody's looking into it. If that's true, Jeff Sessions will go down in history as perhaps the worst attorney general we've ever had.
Well, I'd like to think that some of the blame would lie with Mr. Huber as well, if in fact his charge is to get to the bottom of these things. Joe, let me just ask you to back the lens up here a bit, because what you've shared is evidence, it would seem, of some very bad things going on in the Department of Justice, for sure. And just some, to be specific, I think in the offices of this special counsel, Robert Mueller, you are frequently in public very critical of Mr. Mueller. But informed by what you've just told us, what do you make of the state of this investigation and the likely outcome of it, and if you can, when that outcome might be available to us?
Well, it's pretty obvious that there was no Russian collusion. There never was, and everybody knew that when Mr. Mueller was appointed. Rod Rosenstein appointed Mueller because he wanted a vindictive prosecution, and he got it. This is an embarrassment to federal law enforcement, the Mueller investigation. I have no idea when it's going to end, and that's because Mr. Mueller has been given no time limitation or subject matter limitation by Mr. Rosenstein. This is about massive illegal activity by the Department of Justice under Loretta Lynch, which included the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, the Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division, John Carlin, who filed false certifications with the FISA court about all of these intercepts of American citizens that we alluded to earlier. Right after Mr. Carlin filed his last certification with the FISA court, he resigned because he knew that the then National Security Agency director, Admiral Mike Rogers, was conducting a full-blown investigation to the illegal activities, which Collier would eventually write about. I have no idea where Mueller's going with this ridiculous investigation. It's an embarrassment to federal law enforcement. Bob ought to be ashamed of himself. He should have rejected. About 6 months into this, he should have said, there's no collusion, we're out of here. Instead, he has lingered because Bob has become part of this effort to dethrone a duly elected president of the United States. And it's pretty obvious that his relationships with Comey and Rosenstein have enabled him to go on this long without any accountability. I pray, by the way, that as soon as Bill Barr is made Attorney General, he fires Rod Rosenstein and gets him out of that building.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next with you, as it happens, Joe DeGeneva. Bill Barr is a man you've obviously known for a long time and I think probably worked with closely over the years. Talk about your assessment of him as a new, well, born again, one might say, Attorney General of the United States.
He is the perfect pick. I must say the president has chosen wisely and well. Bill is experienced. He's mature. He knows the DOJ inside and out. He is feared in the building. Let me underscore that for your listeners. Bill Barr is feared inside the Department of Justice by career people because they know he is the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, which makes him a brilliant lawyer. He is the former Deputy Attorney General. He is the former Attorney General. He has argued cases for the Supreme Court and in the Supreme Court for the government and in private practice for clients. He is a perfect choice at this time in history with the department in a tailspin. He will set that place right and will do what has to be done to make it once again the crown jewel of federal law enforcement. It is quite difficult for me to understand how people like Loretta Lynch and Sally Yates and John Carlin and all these people who were there under Obama could allow themselves to be dragged into the politics of the moment, and in the course of doing so, destroy the integrity of the Department of Justice. They have phonily clothed themselves in, oh my goodness, there was all this Russian influence. They knew then, and they know now, that what they did was purely political. There was no basis for any criminal investigation of anybody in the Trump campaign, and most assuredly, no basis for investigating the soon-to-be president of the United States and the then president of the United States. It is the greatest scandal in American history, and the press doesn't care, and the Democrats don't care. That's why the rest of us have to care to set the department and the FBI right.
Joe, perfect conclusion and perfect timing. My friend and yours, Monica Crowley, yesterday called it on this program a coup d'etat, and I think what you've just laid out is an indictment that suggests that's exactly what's been afoot. We'll look forward to hearing what comes of all of this, both with General Flynn and with Bill Barr and with, of course, the Mueller investigation. And, of course, your running commentary on all of it is deeply appreciated, sir. Thanks so much. I know you'll keep up the great work you do at DeGenova and Tenzing. Come back to us again very soon.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Larry Diamond. Larry is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. He has been the editor most recently of a very important new product at the Hoover Institution. It's entitled Chinese Influence and American Interests, Promoting Constructive Vigilance. And we've caught up with Larry early in the morning, California time, and I'm very grateful to him for taking a few minutes to walk through with us the important conclusions of this product, of the collective efforts of quite a number of people who, like him, have spent an awful lot of time on and in China and trying to assess particularly the character of the Chinese regime and the threat that it may pose to us. Larry Diamond, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to discuss this product, and congratulations on it.
Thank you for your interest, Frank.
Well, it's a heightened interest, of course, because I think a number of the people that enlisted in this effort and then contributed to it are people that would not consider the usual suspects in a critical assessment of China, and yet it's a pretty damning picture of the efforts and the extent that the Chinese have gone to try to influence American policy and perceptions of China. Could you just give us the 30,000-foot view of what you all concluded?
Well, yes, China's power in the world is accelerating. China is rising now to superpower status after 40 years of modernization that began with the end of the Maoist era and the rise of Deng Xiaoping. And now China's ready to claim its ambition to be a global superpower, and I think to eclipse American leadership in the world and to basically dissolve the Western liberal order that has secured quite a bit of freedom for ourselves and the world in recent decades. They have basically bought up the Chinese language media in the United States, which are now touting in one way or another the party line for China. They have penetrated American universities, and in some instances, their Confucius Institutes really don't tolerate alternative points of view about China. And in any case, the contracts with the universities are not transparent. They're secret contracts, and we stress that transparency is crucial. The Chinese Students and Scholars Associations on American college campuses are, you know, often linked to Chinese consulates and the Chinese embassy in Washington and are receiving money from them, and it appears instruction from time to time. Chinese overseas students in the United States are being monitored and deterred from expressing, in some cases, their real views about China's policies. And most of all, I think this will particularly concern you, maybe many of your listeners, given your experience in the Pentagon, China's stealing our technology, and they're ripping off cutting-edge technologies in robotics, supercomputing, hypersonics, drone technology, and other cutting-edge technologies that will not only define global economic leadership, but that will determine ultimately, well into the future, who has the edge militarily. So, you know, if Americans want to live in a world in which the single most militarily powerful country in the new era of asymmetric warfare is a kind of neo-totalitarian Chinese communist regime, well, that's one of the scenarios that we're looking at.
Yeah. It seems to be their purpose, at the very least, and well underway, if it's not upon us already. There's much food for thought in what you said, Larry. Let me just drill down on a couple of pieces. Very, very clear to you that the Chinese purpose is to bring about that new world order, if I could call it that, with them as the dominant power militarily as well as economically, and very much at the expense of freedom and the free world?
Well, you know, here, Frank, I think I have a slightly different view than at least some of my colleagues in the working group. I think we probably have a range of interpretations of what China's motive is. At a minimum, I think our colleagues agree that China is seeking to control the narrative and to promote its global interest, economically and otherwise, by preempting and deterring criticism of it, and smoothing its path to global superpower status. But, you know, I mean, you're following this, so you know, you look at its behavior in the South China Sea with these military islands it's building. You look at this Belt and Road Initiative that is not just building infrastructure. If it were idealistically building infrastructure for less developed countries in the world as a humanitarian gesture, I wouldn't be so concerned. But it puts countries into debt by lending this money at commercial rates, and then it says to countries like Sri Lanka, well, hand over to us your strategic port of Hambantota for 99 years, and we'll give you back $1 billion of the debt you accumulated from us. So I think there's a global plan here that is first to push the U.S. out of Western Pacific and then to push the U.S. out of the Pacific. And, you know, they're spreading their tentacles all over the world in a variety of ways. And I think they want to be number one. And look, they're four times as big as us in population. So they're bound to become the biggest economy in the world. But I don't want the most powerful country politically and militarily in the world to be a country that is creating an Orwellian surveillance state that is buying up data and the means to collect it all over the world, and that is, you know, merging George Orwell and Aldous Huxley into some new kind of neo-totalitarian surveillance state in its own borders with growing signs of ambition that they want everybody else's data as well. That's not a world I want to live in.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, and I couldn't agree more with your analysis of this, and I'm heartened that some of your colleagues, at least, have come around to the view that there's a problem here. If they don't fully accept the magnitude of it, it's still somewhat progress.
Well, I do want to stress all of my colleagues have come to the view that there's a problem here. And I think there's a new resolve to redefine the relationship.
Yeah. Well, this is the critical piece, and I really salute you, Larry Diamond, for having gotten this done in this important new analysis of Chinese influence in American interests. I cannot tell you how important I think it is that we're seeing the people who are widely regarded in this country as among the most knowledgeable about China, well, swinging at anchor is one way I think of it, coming to a view that the idea of the peaceful rise of China, as it was long called, talk about narrative shaping, may not mean what we had hoped it would. In other words, it's going to be peaceful as long as nobody resists it, as long as we go along with it and accommodate it. And just to get to one other of your key points here, this totalitarian infrastructure and Orwellian Aldous Huxley melding, I guess the Chinese are calling this sort of the social credit score. And are you seeing, Larry Diamond, the sort of reach of that into places like American campuses, whether it's through the Confucius Institutes in a way, or certainly through the control of Chinese students in the United States? And what does that mean, not just for influence operations, but perhaps for espionage, for the collection of these proprietary technologies and the like?
Well, Frank, you have to divide it into different types of campuses and different types of problems. So let's deconstruct it for a moment. First of all, I think the vast majority of the roughly 350,000 Chinese overseas students in the United States are just not political at all. They're here to get an education, like the college students elsewhere in the world. Many are here to have a good time. They're bringing in staggering amounts of revenue to big state universities like Michigan State, University of Illinois, and so on, parts of the UC system here in California. And my concern there is, for example, with the University of Illinois, where there's 5,600 Chinese overseas students, that they're not mixing with the rest of the population. They tend to aggregate in big dorms that are residences with other Chinese, and they need to be integrated more and drawn out of the cocoons that encapsulate them in part, so they won't be exposed to more liberalizing influences.
Right. With impact on their social credit score, perhaps, as well, back home.
Well, the social credit score is the banner for the Orwellian system they want to construct, but it isn't that advanced now. But, you know, what's happening is that China's leading or trying to lead in artificial intelligence, supercomputing, cloud computing. They're building these massive data storage centers. And in China, much of our data is being stored too. So eventually they're going to have and store everything someone has said politically, everything someone has written on WeChat or some other social media account.
Right. Larry Diamond, this is such a rich seam to mine. And thank you for your time, Larry. I, again, look forward to continuing this conversation, but appreciate having gotten started with it today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say I've met a new friend this week and was so impressed by her and her insights about a tremendously important public policy issue in the United States at the moment that I wanted to grab a few minutes of her time before she headed back to her native South Africa. Her name is Magda Odendaal. She is the CEO of SheNet Global. She is also a member of a new Middle Eastern Women's Coalition that was in Washington this week to talk about the threats posed to our country by Sharia, that totalitarian, brutally repressive, and misogynistic code associated with authoritative Islam. She has in particular impressed me for her insights into one of Sharia's most horrific manifestations, namely its practice known as female genital mutilation, or FGM. I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with Magda about that on this program.
among other things, and would like you to join me in welcoming her. Magda Odendahl, thank you so much for being in America, first of all, for your very important message and for helping us spread it through Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank. It was indeed a privilege to meet with you, and thank you for your time this morning. Good morning, all the listeners. I really do feel welcome in your beautiful country.
Well, you certainly are. Let me ask you to just, in a short form, describe from your own personal insights in what's happening in Africa by way of this practice of female genital mutilation to untold millions of girls and women there, and we have reason to believe increasingly in this country as well.
Yes. As we all know, Africa is a large continent which hosts both North Africa, Middle East, and Middle Africa, and as well as Southern Africa. And over the years, especially the last 20 years, the borders have sort of allowed everyone to just be welcomed everywhere. So, of course, these practices have had become more prominent also in the southern part of Africa. So in my specific situation, I've been a trainer of businesswomen all over the world for the last 22 years. And what lands on my desk mostly is the grown-ups and the consequences they deal with because of being subjected to female genital mutilation when they were little. The sad part of this practice is that it is a culture that is very hard to infiltrate, a culture where women have no rights, a culture where women have no say. They are merely a breeding machine of babies. Other than that, they are absolutely nothing. So this little child has absolutely no say when she is pinned down by adults, her legs pinned open, and she's been what we call mutilized. She has no say. She has to live with that for the rest of her life. So what we're dealing with is a individual that have not been given the privilege to grow into the maturity of any social or emotional intelligence to be able to make any informed decisions about her life, her future, and any of that.
And this will, of course, as you say, be an affliction upon her for the entirety of her life. And just without getting too graphic about this, in the bush in particular, but in lots of places around the world, that pinning down and surgical procedure is done in conditions that are not hygienic, using techniques that are not, shall we say, conducive to careful operations. So the effect, just briefly, Magda Odendahl, the effect on these grown-up girls and the women that you've interacted with, how would you characterize what it has done to them for their lives?
We are dealing with a total distorted personality, a total distorted and darkened self-image. Identity is literally non-existent. These are people when they're grown-ups who have no identity. They don't know who they are, where they are, where they have to be. So you have an emotion that is so scarred that it's very hard to align this human being as a unit to bring them into a balanced individual where you have a balance between your body, your soul, and your spirit.
So it's not just the physical damage that's done, which inflicts pain and can create problems for childbirth and, of course, denies them the experience of sexual pleasure, but it's also a psychological scarring and damage as well. And to just bring this home, because I think for many of our listeners, this sounds like an unbelievable and appalling practice, but they may well be inclined to believe that it's just something that's happening in places like Africa. And yet, as you traveled up on Capitol Hill this week, Magda, you actually were interacting with legislators and members of their staff who had no idea
of the extent to which this problem is present in the United States as well, and in fact, under present circumstances, likely to be an increasing problem at that. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, absolutely. We were in total shock to realize that if action is not taken with immediate effect within days, that the practice of female mutilization would be totally legitimate and accepted in the 23 states of the United States of America. I want to repeat that, inside the United States of America. And people do not have the insight or the understanding of the severity of this. So what we did is we really asked Senate to take action and protect the Americans from a culture that is going to be imposed on them. They will have no defense because it will be legal for them to be attacked and subjected to female mutilization. Yeah.
And this is as a result of a recent ruling by a federal judge. We've talked about it on the program before with other guests, but just to catch people up, that struck down a statute barring this practice in the United States on the grounds that it was there was a technicality, and that what you're saying is, Magda, you and your Middle Eastern Women's Coalition were involved in trying to persuade members of the Senate to fix that technicality and get the federal statute back on the books, because in its absence, as you say, 23 states of this country have no state-level prohibition, and therefore it would be perfectly legal. Magda, this is such an important topic, and I hope we'll be able to come back to you and discuss it further in the future. But before we let you go, I did want to very quickly ask you about what's going on in your own country of South Africa at the moment. You are a white woman there. This is a moment when it's very dangerous to be white, male or female, in your country, apparently. Tell us what's going on and what your experience of it has been.
Yes, it is indeed a dangerous situation for any white person in the country at the moment. And it even doesn't matter if you come into the country from another country. If you're white, you are a target. The belief of that whites has come and stole the land is propagated by very extremistic groups, and who propagate, you know, they are a reward for killing five whites and kill their children, kill their cat, kill their dog, kill anything that comes in their way. Our biggest challenge are these large groups, very, very aggressive groups, who are influenced also by the presence of ISIS in South Africa. South Africa is pro-Palestinian, and ISIS are there openly training their groups. So we are facing multiple forces coming against us as white people. As you know, for a very long time, we have had what we called BEE, Black Economic Empowerment, which excludes the whites from getting jobs, from the total economy. So unless you're smart and you can, you're an entrepreneur and you can work your way into having a business, there are no jobs for you. So we have a growing community of whites also living in dire situations out in squatter camps.
Magda, we are hard out of time, I'm sorry to say. There is obviously so much more to discuss about all of this, but thank you for sharing with us these deeply troubling experiences and insights, and we would like very much to visit with you at greater length at some point soon. In the meantime, thank you for your time today, Magda Odelo. Thank you to all of you for being with us, and I hope you'll be back with us again on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.